Good morning, everyone. Yeah, thank you so much for having me today, and thank you, Doreen, for helping to organise it and inviting me over. I believe you haven't had anyone visiting from London City Mission for a few years, so it's a real privilege to get asked to come over and share with you. I went to London just over 7 years ago to work with LCM, and I thought, this is going to be great. You know, I really want to work with homeless people. I'm going to go over, I'm going to feed the poor, I'm going to tell them about Jesus. You know, how hard can that really be? But definitely within the first couple of weeks of working with London City Mission, I realized how out of my depth I was. When I was kind of really made aware of how many homeless people there are in London, you know, on any given night, you could have over 4,000 people sleeping on the streets. And where I was assigned to work straight away was a place called Weber Street, which is London City Mission's homeless day centre in South London. And the kind of people that come to Weber Street are the sort of people that are barred from every other homeless service in London. People aren't allowed to go to other places, and they would come to us to get fed, to get clothed, for different reasons. And, you know, within, I think it was maybe my second day of work, I had a guy sitting with me who was maybe 6'5", weighed about 15 stone, and he was trembling, he was in tears, and he was telling me how he was in fear of his own life, and he was going to go and kill the guys before they got to him first, and I was expected to counsel and give advice to this guy. You know, it was crazy. I just realized within the first few weeks, you know, just how much pain, how much suffering, how much chaos there really was in the world, especially around us in London. So it was a real learning curve. So I've spent the last 7 years working with the street population over there. And I was actually quite pleased when Doreen told me that you were using this passage in Zephaniah today, or as your theme, because it really speaks to me. So let me use this passage, this chapter, as sort of a starting point of to try and explain, to talk about why mission, and especially urban mission, is so important, why I believe God sent me to the city, to London. The verse in the middle that we've been reading, chapter 3, verse 5, "The Lord within her is righteous. He does no injustice. Every morning he shows forth his justice. Each dawn he does not fail, but the unjust no shame." That's the key verse in the passage for me. It falls in the middle of a chapter that talks about the city. It talks about a city where everything is going wrong. Everyone, even the leaders, or especially the leaders of the city, are trying to do things their own way. They're arrogant, they're selfish, they're violent, they're rebellious. For a long time, they've ignored God's voice. So is it any wonder that their version of justice, their version of what's right and what's wrong, is making such a mess of the city? We shouldn't be surprised. So this passage, when I read it in Zephaniah, it feels very familiar to me. It all sounds like, you know, stuff that I see around me in London all the time. One of my favorite descriptions of what sin is when you describe it as a life turned in on itself, where everything that an individual does, every thought and action, puts themselves at the center. If we believe that that's what sin is, then in a city of millions of people, like London, where everyone puts themselves first, it's normal that there's going to be an overwhelming amount of pain, bitterness, revenge, slander, arrogance, and so on. We shouldn't be surprised by that. It's obvious that sin and pride lead to injustice, more pain for everyone, and it's like a cycle that everyone's caught up in. And it doesn't matter about your social standing. It doesn't matter if you're homeless on the streets. It doesn't matter if you're a banker in the city. It doesn't matter if you're middle class. You know, sin and pride aren't concerned with your social standing. So therefore, neither is injustice. To put it simply, everyone experiences injustice from others, and everyone acts unjustly to others too. Everyone experiences hurt, and everyone causes hurt. But this passage, it reminds us that God is righteous and he is just. He does not fail. He does not change. His righteousness and his justice aren't going to run out. This is a message that everyone needs to hear. And the reason I think everyone needs to hear this is because it's a message of hope. And for me, the people I spend time with in London, they really need to hear this message. They need hope because most of them don't really have anything to look forward to. They generally don't feel like things can ever get any better or improve for them. So the ministry that I'm involved in with London City Mission comes under the banner of marginalized ministry. The word we use is marginalized. So that is our ministry is to people who exist on the margins or on the outskirts of society. People who the mainstream wish to ignore, wish to forget about, or even to get rid of altogether. This was very much highlighted around the time of the 2012 London Olympics, when the pressure on rough sleepers and homeless people was really felt. So I work with people who are homeless, people who are in unstable housing, sleeping rough on the streets. I work with prisoners, ex-prisoners, prostitutes, drug dealers, drug addicts, alcoholics, gamblers, the elderly and the lonely, the mentally ill, and sometimes people who fit into all of those categories. We want to share the gospel with people who are in the margins, people who exist on the outskirts. We want to bring them hope because we believe that God can change even the most chaotic situations. And this passage in Zephaniah, it reminds me that people who live in a world where injustice, pain, and chaos are the norm really need an encounter with God. God who never changes, and he shows mercy to people who have made an absolute mess of their lives. Injustice to me, it means someone being really hard done by and treated unfairly for most of their lives. But it doesn't end there. Injustice goes further. It often leads to people routinely behaving in an unjust way because of what's been done to them. An attitude of entitlement can take root, where they want to take advantage of people and manipulate them as their way of surviving. Let me try and explain this by giving you an example. So the statistics say that 2/3 of people are homeless because of a relationship breakdown. And within that category, most of them are due to abuse or domestic violence. So someone experiences these horrible things and they end up living on the streets. For them, they can often develop, what I've seen this from my experience, they can develop like a warped sense of what's right or right and wrong, a warped moral compass. And they'll often have no issue with breaking the law. So things like shoplifting, stealing, is fine because they feel like the world owes it to them. They get hurt, so then they go and hurt others. That's the cycle of injustice that I'm talking about. I hope that makes sense. But this is where God comes in. He offers something different in the middle of this. God offers something different to cut into the middle of this cycle of injustice, because his good news is that he can see your pain, he can restore you, he can heal you from the bad things that have happened to you, but he's also willing to forgive you of the wrong things that you've done, if you turn to him. So the gospel doesn't only deal with the wrong things you've done, and it doesn't only deal with the wrong things that other people have done to you. When people get the gospel fully, then every single aspect of their life will change. Now, I've been around long enough to see people preach or share half gospels. And when I see this happen, it doesn't really make sense to the people I work with. It doesn't make sense to people in the margins. Because people who feel massive amounts of guilt and shame, but who've also never experienced any real sense of love, they won't get it unless you share the whole gospel with them. That's why I believe, and all my colleagues at London City Mission believe, we have to patiently build relationships with people. We have to try and build up trust and help them slowly take down some of the barriers they've built up around themselves. And this can take years. And the reason why we want to do this is because we want to have a real and honest relationship and friendship to share the gospel into. And with many people, it really does take years. I'll tell you about one of my friends. We'll call him Dave. He comes from the north of England, and he has experienced bullying and abuse for most of his life. He was never able to hold down a job because he always got bullied. And things just got worse for him. When his mother died, he had a breakdown, and his mental health deteriorated very quickly. He came down to London, and the way he survived was he would use his benefits money to buy a monthly travel pass, and he would go around on the buses and the night buses and sleep on the buses. And when things got really bad, he would go to one of the Heathrow terminals and sleep there for a couple of hours until he got kicked out, and then get back in the buses again. And I met him when he came to Weber Street, about 7 years ago, and you've never seen a more broken or timid man. He started to experience violence at the hands of other homeless people. They would beat him up and rob him, and he felt very afraid, very scared, very paranoid, and his mental health kept on deteriorating. Now, soon after this was happening, when I started to build a friendship with him, his father died, and he didn't have a good relationship with his dad, and his brother took this as an opportunity to take advantage of him. They sold the dad's house, and they were going to split the money, and he fell out with his brother over this. And he got his inheritance from his dad's house. And, I mean, it was tens of thousands. I think it was something like 70 or 80,000 pounds he got. And I thought, great, this is an opportunity for him to sort his life out. He's got all the money he could ever need. He'll get off the streets. He'll start putting things back into place. But as the weeks and months went on, I saw this money dwindle away. I don't know if you've seen the sort of digital roulette machines in the bookies in William Hill and things like that. He was addicted to these roulette machines. So the money just went, and he was spending it on other things, which are quite sinister as well. And I was trying to help him take control of this money, but it got to about a couple of months in, and I said, you know, how much is left? You know, can you put a deposit on a flat? And he had like 400 quid left, and I said, come on, let's do something sensible with this money. And, you know, a week later, it was all gone. So he had blown something like £90,000 on nothing. And my point is, it's taken me about 7 years to sort of build a friendship with this guy and a relationship. And I often felt incredibly hopeless, incredibly like there's nothing I can do to help this guy. He's not listening to me. But just last year, he finally accepted help and moved into some supported housing. And he said, he came and told me the reason why he did this is because he remembered something I said to him 3 years ago. And I just thought, you know, that's incredible. And he's doing really well now. I meet up with him and we go out for a cup of tea. We go and play pool. And he comes to our church sometimes. And we've got this amazing friendship. But my point is, it's taken 7 years to get to the place where there's even a tiny bit of trust in that relationship. He was so broken and he built up so many barriers around him that that's how long it took. So how do we do it? How do I build relationships? How do I build trust with people? We meet people from the streets in a number of different contexts. We go to them. The work I'm going to focus on telling you about today is with King's Cross and Camden Street Team. I do still work at Weber Street one day a week, but the majority of my work takes place in King's Cross. And King's Cross and Camden are geographic areas in London that are historically very notorious for drugs, homelessness and prostitution. And the past few years has seen massive amounts of redevelopment in these areas, especially around King's Cross Station. They've really tried to clean the area up. Google bought most of the land behind the station, and obviously they want to make it all look nice and shiny. But the truth is, if you walked through King's Cross, you'd be given a false impression. You'd think it's a very, you know, wealthy, lovely area. There's over 42 million people use that station every year, and they probably all think this is a fantastic, lovely, nice, shiny place. But to us who work there day in, day out, we know the truth. We know that the social problems still exist now more than ever. So we, myself and my team, there's four of us, we make ourselves available on the streets. What I'll do is I'll spend most of my time in the parks and in the spots where I know people hang out and drink and take drugs. And most of the guys I know will either be there, will either be in the bookies, or they'll be in the off-license. So it's actually not hard for me to find the guys I want to spend time with and catch up with them. What we also do is we run drop-ins, which are places where people will come just to get off the streets for a bit of time. And we feel like this is our way of trying to build healthy communities as an alternative to the chaos that goes on out in the streets. So we partner with local churches. They allow us to use their facilities, their church halls, and they provide us with volunteers from the church. Then we'll run a whole service for the homeless guys. We'll do a full cooked breakfast, you know, sausages, hash browns, beans, fried eggs, all that stuff for free. Tea and coffee. We do haircuts. So I do a free barbers for the homeless guys in Camden every Thursday morning. I'll give them a haircut. We set up a laptop with free internet for them to use, a phone. But the most important thing is every morning without fail, we do a gospel talk. We'll do a short Bible reading. We'll do a thought for the day, a little talk on something that we hope will encourage and challenge them. And in these drop-ins in the church halls that we do throughout the week, this is where the best relationship building time happens. We sit and we drink coffee and we really get to know people. And yeah, we do get a lot of people who just come to get the free food. Of course, that's natural. There's a lot of people who somehow have some sort of radar of where to get free things from and they'll turn up. But we also get a lot of people who are incredibly lonely and have nowhere else to go. Like in my Tuesday morning drop-in, which we have in a Baptist church in King's Cross, the majority of people who come are these elderly Irish men who just have nowhere else to go. They can't go to the pub anymore because all the pubs are too expensive for them. Can't go to the bookies because it's too expensive. So they come to our drop-ins and they drink tea And we formed these amazing friendships and relationships with these guys. We'll get people who'll just show up because their feet are rotten from being on the streets and they just want a clean pair of socks. And that's fine. Now, these guys that come along to our drop-ins, most of them will know that we're Christians. They'll know what we're about. They'll hear our morning talks. And this can lead to some very interesting conversations. But many of the guys who come along will have a faith. And for them, these drop-ins and these damp church basements with this kind of sickly sweet tea and coffee and these greasy cooked breakfasts, that is their version of church. The reason that it's their version of church is because they can't go to a normal church. They feel afraid, they feel unloved, they feel unwelcomed. Now, the example I always use to explain this problem is that if someone new turns up to your church on a Sunday, the first two questions you'll probably ask them are, where are you from and what do you do? Now, if your answers to those questions are, I'm from the streets and I don't do anything apart from drink or take drugs or sit in the bookies, you're not going to want to go to a church and be asked those questions. Does that make sense? So for them, coming to us and hearing our talks and having that community is their version of church. So we want to encourage and also challenge people. It's common for people on the streets of London to have a bad view of everyone that they encounter. So let me take, for example, someone who's going to be begging on the street in London. They're sitting outside one of the tube stations with their, you know, cardboard and they're begging to get some cash. Three things are going to happen to that person, or three options. One, they'll be ignored. They'll just see people's feet rushing past them all day and they'll be invisible. Two, they'll be abused. They'll hear things like, why don't you go and get a job? Why don't you go and clean up your act? Why don't you go home to whatever country you come from? Or three, they'll receive a handout. Someone will give them something, will reach them down something, some money or some food or a coffee. Now, none of these three things are healthy in the long term. None of these three things are actually any good for that person. And most people in the public don't realize that. So with us, with what we're trying to do, we want to offer an alternative to this. We want to build a relationship where we can have trust and honesty and, like I say, speak truth into their lives. I'll tell you about another guy I know. We'll call him D. He is a Christian friend of mine. And even though he's a Christian, his life is in a pretty bad place. He lives in a hostel, which is temporary accommodation, which is full of drug addicts, full of alcoholics, full of bullies and gangsters. He has very poor mental health. He hears voices and experiences different things like that. And sadly as well, he's never managed to beat the addictions that he has in his life. He's addicted to crack and heroin and alcohol and cannabis. But he does have a faith in Jesus, so we go and visit him every week and try and spend time with him. We try and read the Bible with him and pray with him and try and help him make good decisions like taking his medication and so on. Now, one day, his key worker, who is a member of staff at the hostel he lives in, stopped me and my colleague and said, you know, I'm really pleased that you come and visit him because he doesn't really have anyone else like you in his life. He's got me and our staff here who just boss him around and tell him what to do. We tell him to clean his room. We tell him to be back home on time. We tell him to take his medication. And then he's got the drug dealers and the alcoholics who he hangs out with. So between us and the drug dealers, he doesn't really see anyone else. He doesn't have any real relationships. And then you guys come along and spend time with him. So that's the alternative that we want to be. We want to step into people's lives and try and have these real relationships with them. So, you know, when I go around and do these sort of talks in different churches, I think a lot of people want to hear really positive, uplifting, exciting stories. And I'm sorry if I'm getting you down the dumps a bit, but it is really hard work. But I'll leave you with a couple of encouraging, positive stories. There has been some good things have happened in the 7 years I've been with the mission. I'll tell you about a friend of mine who I met, again, through Weber Street. He came from Eastern Europe. He was abandoned as a baby in Russia and was brought up in a Russian orphanage in kind of the early 80s. I'm sure you can imagine that must have been pretty grim. He's around the same age as me, so I very quickly formed a good friendship with this guy. He was in a very sad state. He was sleeping on the streets and he was struggling, like most of them, with drugs and alcohol and the lowest opinion of himself that I've ever experienced. And he used to love to lift weights when he was in prison, that was his thing. He loved bench pressing when he was in prison. So one day we took him, I said, I'll take you to the gym. So we went to the gym, and afterwards when he's getting changed, I saw his body, head to toe, completely covered in scars. And I mean, I knew he had problems with self-harm, of cutting himself, but he was completely covered with scars. And I saw the tattoos, and there was one tattoo which was just a number. It was like 1487 or something. And I said to him, I was like, what's that? And he was like, oh, that's me. I was like, do you mean that's you? And he's like, well, that's my number. That's who I am. They tattooed that on me. So he had been brought up just as a number. That was who he was and what he saw himself as. And things got a lot worse for him, especially with the drinking and with the heroin and different things. And he started to self-harm and cut himself very badly. He would slash his throat and slash his face on a daily basis. And I remember him coming to me one day. I was closing up Weber Street and about ready to go home for the weekend. And he turned up and rang the doorbell, and he had been stabbed 3 times in the back by a local gang who he owed some money to. And the base, I just couldn't believe he was still alive. He had been punctured close to his liver 3 times. And he wanted me to help him find his friends because he was scared to be on his own. So I walked around with him trying to find his mates. But anyway, this guy was a mess. I mean, I could tell you many more stories. He used to try and put his head through the window and all these different things. But anyway, eventually I got to the stage where the manager of Weber Street barred him permanently. He wasn't allowed to come back. He nearly stamped the guy to death in the centre one morning when I wasn't there, which annoyed me because I feel if I'd been there, I would have been able to stop that from happening. But anyway, he got barred. He was back out in the streets. He got arrested and got deported back to where he's from in Eastern Europe. And I thought, that's it. You know, all these years of trying to help this guy, and he'll just be back in prison again, or he'll be dead, you know. But then, just before Christmas there, I've still thought about this guy, you know, all the time. And he sent me a message on social media. And I was like, well, for one, I couldn't believe he was still alive. And he started to tell me a story. We started messaging each other back and forth. And I was able to, through the kind of broken English, piece together bits of a story. And he had gone to a Christian rehab in Lithuania. And he got clean of drugs. And he had an encounter with Jesus. He got saved. He'd been studying the Bible. He was going to a church. And he was now serving homeless people there and telling them about Jesus. And I just couldn't believe it. You know, if that was all I ever saw, I could retire now. You know what? That was good enough for me. It was unbelievable. The other funny story is that at the time, about 5 years ago, he had a partner in crime, another guy his age who was almost as rough as him. He had come over to England to live with his sister, fallen out with his sister, ended up in the street, starts drinking, the usual story. And he was going through a lot of the same stuff of cutting himself and getting in trouble with the police for shoplifting and things like that. And he had a group of mates who were older guys who he shouldn't have been hanging around with. They were a bad group of lads. And I spoke to him, you know, over a course of maybe 8 months or so. I was like, you know, we can help you. We can take you to this Christian rehab center. It's a really good place, blah, blah, blah. This went on for months and months and months. And eventually he said, all right, I'll give it a go. So I went down to meet him on a Saturday morning. I was ready to take him to this Christian rehab center to help him with his addictions and so on. And the group of guys who he was hanging around with did not want him to go. They were obviously manipulating this guy because he was younger. And they didn't want him to go, and they started threatening me and so on. But after a while, I eventually managed to extract him, and I got him on the tube. I had to buy him a cup of tea and a packet of cigarettes just to get him to walk up the street with me. Got him on the tube, got him there, you know, showed him in, showed him around the hostel and things like that. And, you know, and I said, okay, you're in safe hands, and I left him. And a few months went by, and I didn't hear anything from him. You know, they're not really allowed to make too much contact, so I didn't hear anything from him. And then about a year later, I was again at Weber Street working one day, and the doorbell went, and I went down, and there he was at the door, and he looked fantastic, and he came up, and I was like, what are you doing here? How are you doing? It's amazing. He said, listen, Luke, he's like, do you remember when you dropped me off at that place that day? And I said, yeah, yeah. And he's like, and you remember you bought me that pack of cigarettes? And I said, yeah, I do. I shouldn't have done that, but I do remember it, yeah. And he said, well, do you know that was the last cigarette I smoked? And he's like, and you know, I haven't had a drink since then. And you know, I haven't cut myself since then. And he's like, I was like, that's incredible, man. I was like, giving him a big hug. And he said, do you know what else? I said, what? He's like, I got engaged to the pastor's daughter. I said, what? What do you mean you got engaged to the pastor's daughter? He's like, yeah, I'm going to Bible college. I'm going to be a youth pastor. And he's like, I came just to say thank you, and I want to pray for you and the work you're doing there. And we stood in the steps outside Weber Street, and he prayed with me. So it was sometimes amazing things happen. God is doing incredible things. So before I finish, I'd love to just give you a few things that you could pray for us as a team, just to leave you with that stuff. Number one, I would love you just to pray for protection over our team. I feel like we go into some very dark places. I haven't even mentioned the prison ministries that we're involved in. Maybe I'll do that another time. But the prison ministries, the streets, the hostels, the people's flats, the parks, whatever. Some pretty dark and horrendous places. So I feel like we need a lot of spiritual and physical protection over us. So please pray that we would be safe as we go around and do this work. Pray that we would stay motivated to do it, that we wouldn't get burnt out, that we wouldn't get, spiritually overwhelmed either. We take on a lot of quite dark stories and issues, and we really care about these people. So you get involved with their lives. So please just pray for protection over me and over the guys I work with. Secondly, I'd ask you to pray for opportunities. A lot of people, like I was explaining earlier, are very closed off. They build up walls and barriers around themselves because they've experienced so much hurt and have been let down so many times. They don't want to let anyone else in, especially not a Christian, because they view the church and Christians a certain way, maybe as judgmental, or that they'll look down on them. So just pray for opportunities that people will allow me to be their friend, will open up to me, will trust me, and I'll be able to have those conversations with them that I want to have. And thirdly, pray for salvation. There's a lot of people that I've known for years and years and years, and they've heard the gospel, and I feel like I've done my bit, but they're just still so cold-hearted, and nothing seems to be changing. And there's nothing I can do. It's got nothing to do with us, does it? It's not us that's doing this work. So just pray for salvation. I would love to see fruit in some people's lives. I would love to see more stories like those two guys I've told you about. So pray particularly. There's a group of four guys in Camden. I won't tell you their names, but four guys in Camden who are drinkers, who I love spending time with, but they're just as stubborn as you can imagine. And I would just love to see God move in their lives. So you could just remember them in your prayers. And the final thing I'd say, if you are interested in finding out more about London City Mission, the best thing you could do is, I've left some of these out the back there. This is our little prayer diary. This has got different missionaries and different things every day that you can pray for. So pick one of those up, please. And this is our Weber Street newsletter. This kind of is some more information about what happens at the day centre. Some cool stories about what's going on, and also things you can pray for. And that's what I think is the most important thing. Please, please pray for us and pray for the mission. Because, like I said, I'm incredibly out of my depth, but I know God is at work and God is doing things. So please keep praying. So thank you.